Welcome to the Fansmanship.com podcast, coming to you from San Luis Obispo, California, with Andy Stevens, Owen Main, and Luke Johnson.
Hot stuff.
Welcome to the Fansmanship.com podcast. It is Monday, April 8th, and Luke and I got a chance to sit down and talk with Eric Steven from TrueBlueLA.com. Eric covers the Dodgers and had some interesting thoughts on the pitching staff, some of the acquisitions and how they're melding into to form here for the Dodgers, and also some of his favorite Dodgers of old. So hope you enjoy the podcast. We are here with Eric Steven of TrueBlueLA.com, which is a part of SB Nation. Eric, how's it going?
Very good. Glad to be here.
Yeah. Welcome to the podcast. We're thrilled to have you here. Eric covers the Dodgers and all things Dodger related.
Nice.
Met Eric at spring training this year. My first question I have for you is, with so many moving parts with the Dodgers this year, what are a few things that you're really watching for over the next, I don't know, month or so of the season that are going to tell you whether or not this Dodger team is kind of for real contenders? I mean, we see it with the Lakers this year, where, you know, you see so many big names and yet not able to contend. And so I think, at least from a fan perspective, there is some hesitation to kind of jump completely on the bandwagon. But what have you seen over the first week, and what reasons should fans have to jump right on that bandwagon with all the other fans?
Yeah, I think the main thing that I'm looking for will be the pitching, specifically the starting. I guess you include the bullpen as well, but the starting pitching was really good in the first week, and I think it has the potential to, you know, sort of be the strength of the team and can continue. They were limited to the spring training, eight starting pitchers deep, so and no one was really unhealthy. We sort of didn't expect much from Billingsley with his elbow problem coming in, but he's been fully healthy, and he's going to be starting this week in San Diego. I think they can put together some runs of really keeping teams down, and if their offense shows any kind of life, they should be really strong. Offensively, I sort of looked coming in to the season, Carl Crawford being sort of a key, because, you know, when they made the big trade with Boston last year, they had a sort of a revamped lineup already. They had Hanley Ramirez, obviously, who's hurt right now, and then they had Adrian Gonzalez, and they had Shane, you know, at the time in the outfield, but, like, you know, it was much better than what they had earlier in the season, but they still couldn't score runs, and I think just adding Crawford to that mix, if he's anything close to what he was in Tampa Bay, gives him a sort of a better dynamic at the top of the lineup, and it really adds a component they didn't have last year. So if he's anywhere close to what he was with the Devil Rays, or with the Rays, I guess, they're in for a treat, and I think he can sort of transform them from a really good offense to, you know, potentially, like, you know, great offense. So
yeah,
I'm really excited to see.
I agree about Crawford, absolutely. It's something I've been talking to Luke and some other people. You know, they said, well, they basically paid all these...
Is he in shape this year?
He is. He's stolen some bases already, yeah.
Good.
Absolutely. And it's something that I've been talking to him about. All that being said, with all the hoopla around the Red Sox trade, is it fair to say that maybe the Greinke signing, you were talking about the pitching being a big deal, is it fair to say that the Greinke signing might be as important as that trade, if not more important, to put him as a second ace on that, in that rotation?
Yeah, I think so. Because it's one thing to have a lot of depth in the rotation, but it's another thing to have a really strong starting rotation from the top down. And I think adding Greinke, I mean, he'd be the ace of most staffs.
Right.
And he's a number one guy, but he's number two to Kershaw here. But man, what a one punch if they do, you know, sort of get into the postseason, gives them a big advantage. To have those two guys at the top, you know, if you can line your rotation up that way, that's, you know, more power to them. But yeah, both he and Kershaw started out, I mean, they've yet to give up a run. They've just been lights out, and it's been sort of fun to watch.
Yeah, and the Dodgers, I think, have a 1 ERA as a team right now, which leads the league. You mentioned
Pretty Chad. Ridiculous.
Yeah, you mentioned Chad Billingsley starting this week. Can you kind of update me on what his status has been? What has he been up to? I know a couple of Saturdays ago in Arizona, when I was there, he threw like a simulated game, but he wasn't throwing any curveballs. What's his status?
Yeah, it's sort of funny. You know, we talked all winter about him coming back from a torn elbow ligament and how they were worried. They went the non-surgical route with him with the two PRP treatments, and everyone's worried about his elbow. And it turns out that it's his, he gets hit in the right index finger on a bunting drill. and then that sort of sidelined him a little bit. The issue with him was he had a bruised right index finger, which doesn't sound like a whole lot, but it sort of it prevented him from throwing a curveball for a little bit because the way he sort of throws it, he presses his right index finger down into the ball. And at the time, the area in that finger, he could have lost a nail. And the area was too sensitive for him to be able to throw a curveball. So he sort of got pushed back a little bit in training. And they not only wanted him to be healthy enough to, his finger to be healthy enough for him to throw a curveball, but they wanted him to be able to sort of get hitters out with the curveball, not just have this sort of passable, really bad curveball.
Right.
So the fingers, like, he actually, it's funny now because he's talking to them, he should be okay. He actually might lose the nail anyway, but the area around the fingernail is the skin has been built up enough, and it's tough enough now that he can throw the curveball with no problems. And he's done, he did one minor league start after that in Arizona, and he did one minor league start with Class A Rancho Cucamonga. So he's good to go, and he should be, you know, sort of raring to go.
Got it. We're here with Eric Steven of TrueBlueLA.com, part of SB Nation. Eric, tell me about the stadium. I know Stan Kasten said that everything was going to be completed in time up to opening day, except for the Wi-Fi, I think he said. I saw Tim Kawakami from the San Jose, I think it's the Mercury News up there, was talking on opening day about how the lack of Wi-Fi might be an issue. Has it been an issue for you guys up there? And tell me a little bit about the renovations that that have taken place and what your thoughts are on all of them.
Yeah, I mean, the renovations, the thing that stands out is the new like high-definition scoreboards. They're pretty massive in both right and left field, and they're both HD, and there's chock full of like new information and stuff, and it's a big change to what they had, and those are the ones that sort of stand out. But they've also made some upgrades on like every level. I've been around to like the top deck and the field levels. I haven't checked out the reserve and lows, but there's wider concourses and some new concession options and some new restrooms and just little things like that. But it seems it's gone over pretty well in that first week. There is still a Wi-Fi issue where, in terms of the people in the stands, I think the Wi-Fi upgrades will happen closer to June, they said. The increased cell phone service should happen by next homestand. That's usually been an issue where it's hard to sort of get any information on your phone. Everyone likes to check their phone every once in a while.
Is having Wi-Fi at the stadium like a common thing now? I don't know. I've been to some stadiums and I don't picture myself getting on Wi-Fi at the stadium, like a public Wi-Fi network. Is that becoming like a pretty common thing in all the stadiums?
I think so. In the newer stadiums, that's been like a sort of a big thing. And I know they upgraded some internal things, you know, for the offices there and things like that. But I know in that first week, the first day there was, or the first homestand, they had some Wi-Fi issues in the press box, and there's nothing worse than a bunch of angry guys, myself included, angry writers who can't get on the internet. So
who can't get on a live tweet?
Exactly.
Best Dodger live tweeter, you or Dylan Hernandez? Go.
Ooh, live. I don't know. Dylan's pretty funny. I think I tweet more often, so I might have to give you advantage to me.
Right. Yeah, you guys are both great. I love following both of your tweets. Of course, you're at True Blue LA, right?
Yes.
Awesome.
Hey, I wanted to go back real quick to Billingsley for a second, and You know, here at Fansmanship, we've always kind of compared him to the American League version of Irvin Santana. He's really hot for like a week, and then he's cold, as you guys know, for a week or two. In your opinion, what has sort of been his issues the last few years as far as never being able to really assemble a full season, the kind of season that we know he could be capable of? Is it mechanics? Is it something, you know, mental? What is it, in your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair comparison. I mean, it's sort of jarring in a way to look back, say, 3 or 4 years ago when essentially he was on the same path as, or was like thought of in the same breath as like a Matt Cain. And then Matt Cain is just like leaps and bounds, surpassed him in like every way. And you see what Matt Cain has done, and then you're thinking, why hasn't Billingsley done that, you know, and all this. I think part of it is also he sort of gets downgraded a little because he's on the same staff as Kershaw, and they're both first-round picks. And I think if you look in the grand scheme of things, Billingsley is the more normal, like, first-round pick progression. And, like, if you look at his career as a whole, it's been a very positive one, and one you would expect out of, they say, normal first-round pick, but, like, Kershaw's more the elite type. And you're like, man, why isn't Billingsley this good, you know, or something like that. So
right. There's
always sort of that dynamic. But, no, I agree. He's been inconsistent at times. And I think part of it is it's really hard to pinpoint, really. Like, I think part of it is being able to just put it all together. Like, I can't put my finger on it, really. He had at some point last year, he was really struggling in the first half last year, and it was a very disappointing season, personally for him, I think. But then, I don't know, something, they changed something mechanically a little bit, and he started to just attack the strike zone around the All-Star break, and then he was like 6-0. And then, of course, his elbow blew out, and then his season was over. So, I don't know. It was just one of those things. Like, it would have been nice to see what he might have been able to put together at the end of the season. But he, you know, he's one of those guys. He always has the stuff. So you hope that he'll be able to put together. Maybe on this staff, they're not asking him to be the two. They're really not even asking him to be the three. He's just a guy on a really good deep staff. So. Maybe he can just sort of fly under the radar.
Take some of the pressure off, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe we will see the best this year. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Great. Recently, and the Dodgers have a lot of pitchers locked up right now, or a lot of players locked up. And recently I saw that you posted something, a post about the Dodgers payroll for last year, this year, and next year, I think. Is that right? As far as the graphic went. What do you think is the Dodgers' best contract that they have on the books right now? And in your opinion, what's the worst contract they have on the books right now?
Wow, that's a good question. In terms of worst, I mean, it's more of a technicality, but it's probably Andrew Jones, since there's him through next season. But like, if it's someone on the team, it's probably like, Juan Uribe still qualifies. He's in the final year of his deal, 3-year, $20 million deal, and it's usually like in a lot of cases. I mean, it's hard to say because the Dodgers really obliterated their sort of budget this year compared to years past.
What budget, right?
Yeah, exactly. There's what limit? Who knows?
Yeah.
So, but you know, it's usually not the higher end guys. Even like a Carl Crawford, who's due like over 100 million for the next 5 years. That's ridiculous in itself. But it's usually not the high end guys that sort of break the payroll. It's like overpaying for like mid-range guys who are just awful. Like in the case of Juan Uribe, they paid him $21 million over 3 years, and in the first few years it was just non-existent. So
yeah.
It's sort of flushing that kind of money down the toilet that usually ends up hurting you more than anything.
Right.
In terms of like best contract, wow. I mean, the Dodgers have never really been one of these teams that that lock up guys early, so they don't have any like long-term type deals.
Right.
They didn't buy out, you know, they still have an extended Kershaw, so I think I will reserve that for when the Kershaw extension finally gets done. I think whenever they can get that deal done, that will be the best contract.
Now, staying on the conversation with contracts, it seems to be between Dodger fans kind of a split opinion regarding the Ethier contract. What's your take on the Ethier deal?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think they definitely overpaid. For me, you can sort of see that. It's not a perfect analogy, but this free agent season, Nick Swisher, he and Ethier are very similar players. The caveat, Swisher is a switch hitter, doesn't have the extreme sort of platoon split that Ethier has. But for the most part, fairly similar players.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, Swisher was, he had the draft pick compensation sort of tag on him, so any team, signing team, would have had to give up a pick. But he signed for 4 years and $56 million with a potential with the option to go five years and $70 million. Whereas Ethier, very similar player, not on the free agent market, signed for 5 years, 85. So I could, you could see they overpaid a little bit for Ethier. But at the same time, I mean, it was, at the time, it was the first splash that the new ownership group did. That was their first contract.
Right.
So part of it, I think part of it was like, it was almost like a good faith tax that they sort of came in. They probably overpaid. They definitely, I think, overpaid for Yasiel Puig as well. I mean, he, as great as he was in spring training, and just he's sort of just hyper on himself. Nobody, he was really on nobody's radar. Everyone was talking about Jorge Soler out of Cuba last year, and he got like $30 million from the Cubs, and the Dodgers paid $42 million to a guy that not that many people were on. So I think they just, part of those early deals were this new ownership group sort of flexing their muscle and saying, this is what we're going to do. We don't really care, you know, what others think. We're going to spend money and you're going to have to deal with it, that kind of thing. So
right.
Part of it is that, but it's not, I mean, Ethier's still a productive player, and so I don't think it necessarily hurts them. I know they do have, you could say Puig is blocked right now, but I don't think he's necessarily better than anyone, so it's not.
Right.
Eventually, it's something they'll have to deal with, but I don't think it'll be that big of a deal for them to sort of move if they have to.
Right, and it gives them some flexibility on the trade market to have so many outfielders and also so many pitchers. They traded Aaron Harang for Hernandez, right, the catcher.
Yeah.
I guess Dodger fans maybe had higher hopes with what to do with some of their catcher depth, especially. Some of their pitcher depth, especially with Fedorovich coming up and being the backup. But in a way, could this be better for T-Fed to get some at-bats in Albuquerque instead of sitting on the bench behind AJ Ellis?
I guess. I would have been fine with him having the backup job. I can sort of see why they did the move, though. Fedorovich is 25. I don't know how much. They say he could develop more offensively, but I don't know how much more he has really to develop.
Yeah, he was hitting the ball pretty well in spring.
Yeah, he's doing okay. I mean, like, I just think, like, it helped them overall in terms of they don't really have anyone after Fedorovich in the system who's close to Major League ready. And as bad as Hernandez was last year, he dealt with a hand issue that cost him, like, 2 months. So if he's anywhere close to healthy, he's probably better than Fedorovich, and at least offensively. So, I don't know. It helps him a little bit on the depth standpoint. I didn't think they were going to get much for in my view, I think of the eight starting pitches they had, Harang was probably eight. You can make an argument that he was seven or eight. But
I
don't think
they
were going to get more than like a C prospect or something like that for him anyway. So
right.
I can see trying to sort of they just sort of shifted their resources in a way where they, instead of having this excess starter, they now have a little better catching depth, and they still have starter depth. So I think it was a decent move.
Absolutely. We're talking with Eric Steven from TrueBlueLA.com. Eric, were you around last year, and what kind of a tangible difference is there in the clubhouse comparing last year to this year? I know I asked a few of the players about it, but for you, what kind of a tangible difference is there kind of around the team that you can see?
I think in the clubhouse, I mean, you could definitely feel this year there's higher expectations. I know last year, for the most part in both years, it's been a relatively, like, there hasn't been any, like, real issues in the clubhouse in terms of, like, there's no real, like, jerks or war. It's generally a positive clubhouse. I think this year, though, they've obviously added more veterans than they had at the beginning of last year, and I think they're a little more professional in terms of, like, Adrian Gonzalez, Hanley Ramirez, they all have their approach. And they know, they've been around the game a while, they know what they're doing, they sort of have their routine, and that's what they stick to. And but I think there's definitely, they all sort of know that they're expected to win, and I think they are confident in the fact that they want to win. But yeah, I mean, tangible difference, it's really tough to say. Other than that, I think they know what the expectations are, and I think they're ready for it.
Yeah, and in the clubhouse, that's one thing, but also organizationally, is something that players talked about, having the new ownership meaning kind of as much or more than Dodger fans even think, as far as support for the players, wanting to win, having that mindset that is, you know, we got to win every day. I was listening to the pregame show yesterday with Trey Hillman, and he was talking about, you know, players wrapping their minds around that being the expectation, a World Series and a World Series championship. Can you talk a little bit about organizationally? I mean, you're around the team on a daily basis. What does that look like compared to last year?
Well, sure. I mean, I'm sure, I mean, the players, more than anyone, they see all the things that this new ownership group have done. I mean, it's hard to say many things, like, negative about them. They've almost done, I mean, they were following Frank McCourt, so they were going to get a large amount of rope in terms of, like, you know, they had to be better than him. So, just from a public relations standpoint, but I mean, it seems like they've spent money in every possible way. They've spent it on players. They've spent it on upgrading the stadium. They've not only, like, McCourt started the renovations of the stadium, but he did field level first and then sort of ran out of money to do the rest. And
yeah, and the field level renovations that McCourt did, I didn't even like very much. I don't know. I felt like it kind of took away some of the sight lines if you're sitting kind of mid first level. I don't know. That's my opinion.
Yeah, and then so they went through and sort of completed that, but they did it on the levels that your average Joe fan sits at. They did it on the reserve and the lows and the top deck and things like that. And so they've upgraded that. They've upgraded the clubhouse, which is amazing. It's like last year you couldn't, you could almost like stretch your, if you have a normal wingspan, you could have almost reached across from one locker to the other. I mean, I'm exaggerating a little, but it was super tiny. This year, it's the upgraded facilities. They have an awesome, like, weight room area. It's more of like a health club than a weight room. Great training area. Just every little amenity they could think of, I think they've sort of added. And they've definitely raised the bar.
Right.
And I think, but it's, in a way, it's not that the players are getting, like, coddled or something like that. It's more like they've seen, they're like, wow, it's like fires them up, because not only are they upgrading, you know, the facility, they're upgrading their talent around them, so they know that, you know, they need to sort of win to live up to that. And I think, and it's been like a, it's sort of a good, in a way, I mean, it's challenging, but it's a like challenging in a positive way. It's not like setting some unreasonable goal and lashing out at them or anything like that. It's like,
right.
It's just setting the bar, and I think they, you know, well, I mean, we'll see. We don't really know how they respond, but we'll see how they respond to that, I guess, folks.
I call it the Mark Cuban factor. The you know, you hear these stories about when Mark Cuban came to the Mavericks and they were, you know, they would skimp on everything. They were kind of similar to how the Clippers might have been back then, and, you know, they talked about things like him getting, like, fluffier towels in the locker room and stuff like that. Just the kind of the little things that players notice on a daily basis, and especially in a game like baseball, where they're in that clubhouse, you know, 81 days a year at least, and they're, you know, they're playing every single day for so many months. Every little thing probably makes a big difference to them.
Yeah, I love the Cuban towel story too. Like, You know, that was one of those things, like, you know, NBA is even more so because you have salary caps. So you have to, like, you have to think of other ways to, I mean, it's not compensate players, but you have to think of other ways to stand out. And he, like, he obliterated the sort of ways to think about, like, you know, little amenities like that. And I think that's where the Dodgers, they we're talking about them spending money. They've done it on scouting. They hired these new international scouts. They're spending internationally now. So, I mean, they're doing every possible thing, I think, tangibly that they can, and I think it's showing.
Great.
Hey, last year we went to Fansmanship went to a game at Angel Stadium. It was Dodgers Angels, and yeah. I'd never really cared much for D. Gordon, but Owen actually tapped me on the leg and he said, "Watch this." And it was kind of a cool story. Gordon had just like a little bloop single to right. He got on first, and Owen said, "Watch, he's gonna light the base pass up." No joke. In a matter of probably a minute, the guy stole a couple bases. A wild throw later by Iannetta, and he's home scoring. And like it seemed like in a blur, like 15 seconds. What is your take as a, you know, as a Dodger fan and as a beat writer? I mean, what is your take on D. Gordon? I mean, has he fallen trap maybe to his own, I mean, to the fact that he's so speedy on the base pass? And so we're kind of hoping for something that maybe he isn't, or, I mean, do you see something there? I mean, can he develop into that player that a lot of us hope he can?
Yeah, I think he can. I mean, he was highly rated by, you know, like Baseball America and some other prospect people like Kevin Goldstein when he was at Baseball Prospectus, and he showed things in the minors. Like he can hit a little bit. You know, he has some skills, not just, you know, just be on the base running. And I think last year they rushed him a little bit. He bottomed out to where I don't think he's going to get worse than he was last year. It was a really bad year for him. And I think that they didn't want to rush him again this year with Hanley out. They did want him to sort of develop a little more in AAA. So they're sort of letting him do that right now, and they have hopefully it'll work out in the long term for him. But I do think he will be a productive player. He's one of those guys. He is very exciting to watch. If he could develop in any way to where he can, you know, become like just a passable offensive player, he's going to be one of those guys that's super exciting to watch on the bases. Like, I think I remember the game you were talking about. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, he stole second, third, and home in that game. If I'm not mistaken, or maybe
it's possible.
Maybe I'm thinking of just
yeah. You know what? It happened so quick. I can't even remember. But I know for a fact he stole two bases, and it might have been actually a wild pitch that he got home on. I'm not sure.
And we did have to leave a little early because we went to the Galaxy game directly after. We got to make the most out of our trips to the LA area from San Luis Obispo here. So we went to the Dodgers Angels and then directly to Carson and saw our first Galaxy game on the same night. So that was quite a sports night.
That's cool.
For those of us from, you know, who have to drive 3.5 hours to get to the ballpark. Angel Stadium, worst press box in the majors?
Well, they just moved it this year to from, it was one of the better vantage points in baseball.
Yeah.
Because it was not only behind home plate, but it's on the lower level. So you have a really awesome view of the game. Had an awesome view of the game because they moved it this year to way down the right field line. And I'm, you know, I did cover two of the freeway series games last week there, and it was tough. I mean, okay, I can get over the fact that, like, through part of the press box you can't see home plate, which is, it seems absurd, right, to say that. But I can sort of get over that. But it's like part of it for me is, like, it just takes so long to, like, get from there to go down to the clubhouse, like, and especially on the Angels, like, it gets all the way together. You're almost going south pole, south pole. So just,
right.
If I had to cover like 81 games there, I'd be a little perturbed, I would say. but on the same level, you can almost understand it from an ownership standpoint. That really is prime real estate back there, and you probably can see the bottom line. If they get any kind of luxury suites in there, they can make a ton of money selling those. The usual the usual move for press boxes is to just be behind on plate, but just up further levels. I don't. Maybe it's harder to do that there because they don't have as many levels. Like I know, like Washington, and I think the new Busch Stadium has the press box on, like, well, I guess Dodger Stadium would be the equivalent of like top deck.
Right.
So it's just a little higher, which is understandable. But I think even that would be better than way out in right field. It's a tough vantage point to be sure.
Yeah, I wasn't a big fan of the Angels Stadium. Luke's kind of an Angels fan, but
kind of. Come on,
Luke's
now.
A big Angels fan, but. I had to, you know, even Dodger Stadium before the remodel, like, you know, it wasn't even close. And you guys are going down to Petco now. I love that park. I think it's just one of the cooler downtown parks that there are out there.
Yeah,
it's a pretty cheap ticket too. Maybe not for Dodger games, but for Southern California sports fans to go to a baseball game, you know, the Padres aren't that great, and you can get a pretty good seat for not that much down there at Petco. It's a really nice stadium.
Yeah, I really love that park. I went to school down here in San Diego and went to Qualcomm at first and then over to Petco, lived down here for a while, and it's one of my favorite non-Dodger Stadium parks, I guess.
We are both Tritons, actually, me and
right.
Eric's team. What year did you graduate at UCSD?
2000.
2000, well, we overlapped by 1 year.
1 year. Oh. Hey, Eric. Owen and I kind of have a never-ending game that we play. We text each other throughout the day, you know, random baseball players' names, random, you know, sometimes basketball guys or football guys. Actually, not usually football. It's basketball or baseball.
Usually from about 1985 to 1990.
Sometimes college basketball, too, which is pretty great. But we're going to do this with the Dodgers real quick. I have a fond memory of being at Dodger Stadium in the early 90s, maybe mid-90s, and Carney Lansford was the starting left fielder.
For
the Dodgers.
Did Carney Lansford play for the Dodgers?
The last couple of years. It was pretty random. But anyways, that's kind of one of those random names that sort of brings kind of a nice memory to me, you know. So give me a couple random Dodgers throughout your entire fanfare of the Dodgers that kind of, you know, have given you fond memories, even though to most they aren't really, you know, worthy of being named.
Like a pretty fun. it's hard to come up with one offhand. I would say, in a weird way for me, I guess two come to mind. One good and one bad, but in a sort of positive way. One, Jeff Hamilton.
Yeah, right on, man.
Third base.
He never lived up to like the promise that he showed or that they had for him. But the thing I remember most about him was not that him as at the plate. He was played a 22-inning game in Houston in 1989. And I remember I was at my grandma's house watching that game, and I want to say it was a Saturday night. I could be wrong. But I watched that whole game, and which was quite a feat.
22 innings.
Yeah, and so, but at the end of the game, Hamilton pitched, like, the last two innings.
Wow.
And he ended up taking a loss, but it was a tough loss because he was actually a pretty pitcher for a position player to just come in and do it. But at the end of the game, the Dodgers had Hamilton on the mound. They had Eddie Murray at third base.
Yeah.
And Fernando Valenzuela at first base.
I do remember that Fernando came in to play first a few times because he could hit.
And it's one of those like crazy memories that you forget. Yeah. But the other player that sort of came to mind, who's still with the organization as a minor league coach now, is Franklin Stubbs.
Franklin Stubbs, right on.
He hit my brother and I went to a game in 1988, and he hit a grand slam against Todd Worrell that capped a 7-run rally in the 8th inning. And I just remember going to that game with my brother, and it was super exciting, and it's like one of my favorite like Dodger Stadium memories growing up. So I feel he'll always be sort of remember for that.
Was Worrell on the Cardinals then?
Yes.
Yeah.
He was like awesome. Really good too. Like,
yeah.
Closer.
He was.
Probably like his third year.
Yeah, he was a stud for a while. The couple for me are like Alfredo Griffin and John Shelby.
Oh, nice.
I saw Griffin. I went to a day game on that on like the last Monday of spring training, and we got first row seats right behind the plate for $35 on the day of the game. Love spring training. And Alfredo was down there and kind of brought back the memories of the 88 team. I read an article, I think, on FanGraphs or Baseball Reference a week or two ago, and it talked about players with a certain amount of plate appearances or at-bats in their career, and it, there was like a limit. It was like, I don't know, 3,000 or 6,000. I don't even know what the number was. But out of all those players, and there were like, I don't know, 100 or something, or 200 of those players, maybe six, no, there were 600 or something of those players. Alfredo had like the lowest numbers of all the players with, yeah, with that many at bats. And it kind of makes you wonder, I mean, he had to be like pretty slick with the glove or something had to be right about what was going on for Alfredo. And I always remember I used to watch, I was seven in 1988. So the John Shelby, years with the Dodgers, I always thought his bat was like too big, a little bit too heavy. I always like thought that to myself, and I was, you know, 7 years old. So what did I know? But, the way he held it, that's a memory for me for sure.
Yeah, the 1988 team, it still holds a special place in my heart, and I look back fondly, like, pretty much anyone who was associated with that team, I get a big kick out of, so I like those guys.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons why I was mad at Luke and his first baseman last year, Albert Pujols, because I was upset that that he got Mickey Hatcher fired, because I always had a, Mickey Hatcher was the first autograph I ever got.
I was actually mad, too. I love Mickey Hatcher.
There you go. All right. Well, Eric,
you can look at it this way.
No.
Mickey Hatcher, at least like once he's back, or he was back with the Dodgers after the Angels fired him. So in a way, he sort of brought him back. So there you go.
There you go.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks, Albert. We'll take it. Well, Eric, I really appreciate you joining us. It's been fun, and hopefully we'll have you on the podcast at least a couple more times before the season's over, talking Dodger baseball.
Absolutely, it's my pleasure, guys. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to the Fansmanship.com podcast. For more news, opinions, and podcasts, go to www.fansmanship.com.
Well, I've been stuck on down in Trouble Town. It's a lonely place, it's true. Street lights so bright, they blind my vision. And the people on the streets, they beat me up till I'm blind.